Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Matt.
Hi, I'm Katrina.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you
too.
And
we actually did meet, I think, for the first time last night.
Yes.
At the speaker reception. So it's fun to get to know you. We've had a wide ranging discussion on so many topics, covering everything from stingrays to chickens to Jason Miller to superlatives that are used far too casually in both countries.
Absolutely.
Maybe we'll start. Tell everybody like who you are and what you do.
So my name's Katrina Neal. I work for LinkedIn out of the London office.
Okay.
Jason Miller sits within paper throwing distance from me.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I started there about 11 months ago.
Wow.
With the fabulous job title of content marketing evangelist.
Nice.
And the jazz hands are compulsory.
The jazz hands are part of it. Like it's part of the, like, so on the business card, There's a GIF in your email signature. Evangelist.
Although somebody did suggest that to be truly American, I should get some foam fingers, like evangelist, especially orange ones.
Is that what we're known for, is the foam fingers?
I don't know.
I'm actually quite worried that, like, people overseas, they're like, this is a very diverse country. We've got all kinds of different people. And you think of us based on, like, you know, the NFL football fans, you know, sitting in the third row or third level. I don't know.
No judgment. That was just the first thing that somebody said to me.
Just foam fingers. All right.
So I don't know anything about you, Matt. I scanned your LinkedIn profile.
Sure.
And I saw you had a passion for demand generation and you kept chickens, which I thought was quite interesting. So what do you do?
Not necessarily in that order. So yeah, so I run a company called Heinz Marketing. We're a B2B sales and marketing consulting firm out of Seattle. Do work with companies all over North America, helping them build and sustain pipeline, B2B pipeline for their sales teams. Been doing it on my own for about 9 years, kind of grown a nice little business, nice little team up in Seattle. And we live in an old, about 110-year-old farmhouse outside of Seattle with got 3 kids, a dog, 10 chickens, 2 rabbits, a goat on the way.
A goat on the way?
A goat, we're not pregnant with goats, but like there's springtime plans to bring in the goats as well. And speaking of animals, so like, you know, I don't know about in England, but like in the States, like having chickens in the backyard has become kind of a normal thing. So when you hear someone say they have chickens, it's like, okay, fine. I don't even think twice, but you have stingrays.
Yes.
So talk about that. I know we're probably supposed to talk about enterprise marketing, but just the stingrays first. We're going to talk about stingrays.
We can make the bridge. We can make the bridge on this.
Yeah, I just got approval to talk about stingrays. So you don't have to bridge it. I'm just curious about the stingrays.
We were talking about chickens because to me, not that many people keep chickens in
right.
the UK. But Joe, the last time I saw Joe talk, he was talking about the Chicken Whisperer and that there was a podcast.
Yeah.
And I told him about my husband's developing business of selling freshwater stingrays.
Yep.
And he kind of sort of took a step back and like, really, that's a bit niche or niche.
It is one of the two. Yeah.
We can now order stingrays online and we're building an audience first. We're doing content.
It's
blogs, all about helpful, inspiring, entertaining content.
It sounds fascinating. I mean, just to hear someone talk about like stingrays in sort of any kind of a domestic environment, it's fascinating. Now, here's what I'm thinking, like to serve a couple of purposes. So we have 10 chickens now, or I built a new coop this past spring that we can have up to like 18. So we'll probably end up with somewhere between 10 and 15. So we have 3 kids. And they're 8, 6, and 4, so they're still a little young. But a lot of kids, when they get a little older, they do like a lemonade stand, right? I want my kids to have an egg business.
Nice.
Right? So, you know, as the eggs come out, they're all organic. They're all naturally fed. And you could go around the neighborhood and get a subscription. Like, you can subscribe to the eggs. So you want 6 a week, you want a dozen every other week. Great. We'll take care of it. Swipe the card. We can have a website. This, you know, they all have names, right? Like, some of them were named by my wife, so they have names that are like Petunia, like named after flowers. And then you can tell those are named by my kids. One of them is Popsicle.
Okay.
Another one is Easter, because we got them right around Easter, right? So they've all got their own stories. So I think that, I don't know what you think. I think
we started, I've got a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they started naming the stingrays. The first one was Pancake, for real.
Well, I can see that.
But we're at about 200 now. So we kind of lost track on the naming convention.
Okay, I now have a whole bunch more questions. Now, so you must live in a small flat somewhere downtown. Now, but where do you put 200 stingrays?
I mean, everywhere. They're in my kitchen,
in
my living room. They're in the garage. The kids have got, the kids don't have stingrays in their bedrooms. But it's a serious thing that I find entertaining. I mean, I I've been in corporate marketing. I worked for Cisco for 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, that B2B thing with the big budgets. You know, I ran global content marketing.
Yeah.
And to kind of really bring it down to grassroots.
Yeah.
When my budget is £100.
Yeah.
You know, it really makes you scrappy. And, you know, I've taught myself WordPress.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm doing A-B testing on Facebook. You know, it kind of blends my geek nature of loving content marketing.
But to bring it back to the B2B side, I mean, like, what's fascinating about this is, I mean, we could go on forever and we could eventually talk about B2B marketing or LinkedIn. Or,
we could.
But, like, this is more fun. And I think, you know, no matter how big a business you're selling to, it's just people talking to people, right? Like, buildings don't write checks like we do.
Yeah.
So to get to know someone behind the company as a buyer or as a seller is interesting. Like we just finished some research where we were looking at buyer behavior and buyer trends. And we were looking at what are the attributes of suppliers that buyers most appreciate. And very high on the list was a relationship with someone at the supplier company, right? And that relationship can be based on a subject matter expertise, or it can be just something that makes them stand out. Like for the last year and a half, every one of my presentations will usually start with an offer of giving away some content that we have, as well as my award-winning bacon recipe. And it's won no awards. I just call it that. And all of a sudden, you know, so now, like, I'll see people at conferences and they'll want to talk about bacon, right? Or they'll talk about chickens.
Do you have a bacon blog?
I have a bacon blog post about the bacon. It's a very simple recipe. We can get through that as well if you want. But I think it's being unique, being remarkable as a company and as a brand. And we saw some good examples of that here from GE and from others, but also as an individual, right? And if you're in B2B and you're selling, and I think about this in the context of even LinkedIn and Sales Navigator. You know, all of our clients using Sales Navigator, I'm in it all day long. The kind of insights you can share, as well as that you can glean and follow up with. I mean, I think sometimes I get deals by remembering someone's birthday or by congratulating their college team on a win this weekend, because you're providing value. You're showing that you pay attention. You're, in some cases, showing empathy to people beyond just the deal. And that can help you stand out.
I mean, one of my standard slides that I have in my masterclasses I run, you know, you talk about, you know, from my time at Cisco, you had the B2B sales dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bring up a nice picture of Mad Men, having those lovely lunches. And we talk about, you know, they had some fine wine, they would share some jokes, it'd be entertaining, educational, a little bit of gossip. And it's about taking that online.
Yeah.
You know, the moments when your customers are not in the room with you, you know, someone else is going to get their ear. And can you really, truly replicate that? I mean, I was a remote worker for nearly 10 years. So I worked from my home office. And that human touch is still very tangible. I think once you make that initial connection, you can sustain it in a digital environment with those really complex deals, with those complex human interactions.
Well, and that's a big, you know, when I think of social selling, that's a big part of it, right? It's a relationship, it's connections beyond just the deal. But how do you teach people to do naturally that level of sort of agile content marketing? I mean, I think, you know, Ann Hanley has said everything the light touches is content. So saying happy birthday to someone is content. Congratulating their, you know, football team on a great match this weekend, like, that's content, right? But, like, it's not for companies that are used to, like, processing content, right? Drafting something, reviewing something, publishing something, that more spontaneous, more frequent, more agile content. I mean, given your role on LinkedIn and, you know, doing the master classes, have you found that that's difficult for companies to adopt and scale?
It depends on the organization type.
Yeah.
The kind of use cases I would see is that individuals are nervous about publishing. They're not natural writers.
Yeah.
There could be a social media policy where people want control over what employees say, think, and do. And, you know, one of the components of making LinkedIn work is having an employee sharing platform. So we have a product called Elevate. You know, there are other platforms out there. But that really, you can craft the content with that voice, that brand voice that's been vetted. And then it literally pops up on your phone and you can share it.
Yeah.
So you're creating content, curating content for your employees. And that seems to be a nice balance for people. And obviously, you still have your, you know, people that write on the platform, you know, articles. But that seems to be a good halfway house for people that may not be so comfortable or willing to relinquish control.
So I have to ask you the question that everybody's asking, everybody's wondering. Kate's pregnant again.
Yes.
Like, when does it end? Like, how
I'm
many?
So
how
glad
many?
I saw that in the news. Otherwise, I'd be like, who's Kate? Yeah. You know, what's that about? I don't know. Is it a boy? Is it a girl?
I don't know. I just like, well, it's what's
I'm
funny.
I'm very happy for
there, there's a, having two kids is sort of, okay, you're married, you have two kids. And then like, we have three. And when we got pregnant with a third, people are like, what?
Yeah.
Another? What are you doing?
I always say to my kids, I have two arms, like exactly. One for each of you. And I don't know what you're doing with the third one.
Well, people say like, you know, you go from man to man to zone defense, right? Like there's no man to man defense on two kids. Like it's zone with one, right? Just been all around everywhere. It's nuts. So I know I promised you I wouldn't ask any like product roadmap LinkedIn questions. So I won't ask that, but I'm still curious, like what are the points of resistance you see with companies that aren't yet adopting elements of social selling? Like if you're doing B2B selling, I don't know how you can not use LinkedIn at this point. I mean, like kudos to LinkedIn for creating an ubiquitous tool that has, you know, market share and critical mass in literally every B2B industry now. But there's still plenty of companies that aren't using it. What are their excuses? Like, what are the answers that they give to that question?
It's very simple. It's the people. It's a human being's reaction to change.
Yeah.
You know, I was at Cisco for a very, very long time. And my personality type is very much about transformation, making change. But, you know, if you kind of map some of those personality types to an adoption curve.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a lot of pragmatists and conservatives.
Yeah.
And it's learning how to talk to them. It's a change management exercise. And when we saw it this morning with GE, you know, you're the lone person with the idea. I mean, if you actually look at that adoption curve, you know, it's only the first 20% of those innovators, those thought leaders. The whole 60%, they're resistant. They don't want change. You know, and it depends on the organization. But I think for me, it's when it comes to that trigger.
Yeah.
That moment where the pragmatists say it's worth the risk.
Yeah.
You know, they stop fearing that things could be worse than the status quo. So it's very much the human beings, the process, and it's just time. I think you have to have patience when humans are evolving and change. That's my experience. You know, as a marketer, I used to read all about, you know, the funnel, and you know, I'm absolutely a direct marketer, and I find myself reading change management books, like change management theory. How do you get people to change? And then again, this morning we heard it was really about appealing to people's emotions,
right?
You know, not the logic. And considering I just did a talk about the rise of the data scientists and being data driven, you know, there's still that human element,
of course.
That primeval element.
There always will be.
Yeah, so,
When we work with a lot of companies trying to help the marketing team embrace revenue responsibility. And I think a lot of, in B2B, you still have a lot of marketing groups that really are sort of glorified darts and graphs departments that aren't even focused on leads, let alone pipeline and revenue. And the biggest challenge is the same. It's culture. I mean, you'll have a CMO that is just deathly afraid of being responsible for anything related to the money. Like I said, I don't control when the deal closes. Like, well, your sales team doesn't really control that either. So let's take control off the table and just try to like focus on the same goal. So that those cultural changes, I don't think we put nearly enough focus on that when we're trying to get someone to adopt a new approach, when we're trying to get someone to change their number. You know, I've done a handful of sort of LinkedIn trainings for some of our clients, and I'll never forget this one manufacturing company. It was like, you know, 60-year-old company. A lot of the sales reps have been in the job for 35 years, kind of crusty old manufacturing guys. And, you know, their head of sales market says, I want you to do a LinkedIn training. I'm like, I'm bracing myself for how bad this is going to be. Some of the best adopters during the break, like we took a break and said, okay, work on your profile, do all these things. There were a couple guys that were the crusty guys I thought were going to be the most troublemakers. They were in. They bought into it. And I think part of the reason is because I think whenever we try to bring in some change or bring in something new like that, the last thing I want to do is start with the technology or start with the tool.
Yeah. Like this isn't about. I have made that mistake.
Well, it's easy to do. Yeah. Like when you're excited about it and you know that that's how they're going to get there. Like I started by talking about relationship selling, right? I started by talking about the importance of relationships still today, that in a crazy fast world that's increasingly commoditized, the relationships still matter. My dad was a Caterpillar tractor sales rep. For him, relationships were everything. So I tell those stories first to talk about the fundamentals of selling and the psychology of selling before I then say, okay, but then here's how you apply it. Here's a set of tools that if my dad had them 30 years ago, he would be all over them because they can scale very efficiently what he was trying to do just with a telephone and a car.
But yeah, I think at the heart of it is very much change. And, you know, I was looking to bring in a new... Hi, Andrea. We were looking to bring in...
Bring in a chair.
Come and sit down.
We'll make it. It's like the Merv Griffin show. Look who just popped by, everybody.
I didn't photobomb Artif and Andy, so I'm making up for it now.
All right. Fantastic. Anyway, you were saying...
No. And I think, you know, the attraction of a number of platforms, if you automate a bad process, yeah, you just get quicker at doing things badly. But, right, you know, I was looking at Compose, a content marketing platform, as trying to manage a global content marketing team.
Yeah.
As a manager, you know, it was ticking all the boxes. Yeah. You know, understand your production, where are the bottlenecks in that production? Because, you know, there was once upon a time where I would... my team would try and get an email campaign out. It took 6 months to create an email campaign. I'm like, no, seriously, guys, how is that even possible? And it would be like this.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, what if we can document a workflow,
right,
and say, it was the brand team, it was whoever. That seemed like a good thing to me, because reducing your costs as well as generating revenue are equal of interest to your CFO. So I was all over it going, yeah, this is it. This is the way we're going to do things. And, you know, the team still found it very difficult to change the way they did their job. I mean, you'll fundamentally change what people show up every day and do.
Yeah.
And that cultural shift doesn't happen just by switching on some software. That was a huge lesson for me. You can get blinded by all the benefits, but you have to really consider that emotional reaction to the software.
So talk a little bit about, like, you talk a little about process and systems. Another way that I think about that sometimes is habits, right? Like if I'm doing like relationship selling, if I'm trying to sort of stay in front of my network or my pipeline on a regular basis with, you know, buying signals and trigger events, best to do that on a regular basis. I find that some companies seem to resist process, seem to resist systems because they see it as draconian and they see it as not nearly as agile as they want to be or want to appear to be. What do you think about that?
Oh, wow. I mean, I've worked for myself. Yeah. I've worked for a global company. I've worked in corporate. I've worked in region. I've worked for startups. There's a whole difference between process. I've been at the complete end where there is so much process you can't even breathe.
Right, right.
To there's zero process and everybody is falling over themselves. There's duplication everywhere.
Right.
And there's kind of like a happy medium, but... I've only recently got to know Jeff, but agile marketing, you know, I absolutely adopted that at Cisco as this halfway house. Yeah. So I decided, because the waterfall project methodology just was not working for me, we would have this beautiful plan. This is what we're going to do for the next 8 months. And then by the time we got to 8 months, it wasn't fit for purpose anymore.
Right.
So I did my Scrum Master training. Mm-hmm. I was the only marketer in the room.
Really?
They're all software developers. And they're like, who's this chick? Right. and so I understood the principles. But whilst I was trying to implement Compose, I also tried to implement Agile at the same time. I mean, my poor team, you know, it was...
Well, it's a balancing act. I think, you know, agility is used as an excuse for having no strategy. And I think you have to have a strategy to do Agile effectively. Because you still have to know what the end goal is. You still have to know what you're working towards. And the tactics you use to get there may change and things you try may not work. And so you make adjustments. But if you don't have a general strategy of what you're trying to do and how you think you're going to accomplish it, then it just seems like random acts of marketing that may or may not go anywhere and may waste an inordinate amount of time that, you know, I mean, it seems to me like when I think about like helping our clients build pipeline. Like my goal is to get them to a point where they've got a repeatable, predictable, scalable process where they can do a lot of the same things and generate the same results. Now, what's going to work is going to change over time, but like process and system and replication, like that's the goal. Like that's got to be part of the strategy to be able to scale what you're doing. You introduce a new person to your sales team, bring someone else onto your content team. Like if they have to start from scratch or somehow figure out whatever institutional knowledge exists to get their job done, you can't run a business that way. I don't care if it's a 20-person manufacturing company or a $100,000 global enterprise.
But again, when you're being an innovator and trying to make change, like GE was saying, it can be a bit ugly, and you don't. It's not a fully formed thing. As you iterate every 2 to 3 weeks, you know, things become a little clearer, and you know, the more pragmatists and conservatives were uncomfortable because we didn't know exactly what it was going to look like. I said, well, we're building this as we go along, and what we thought it was that was over here might actually end up being over here. So I felt entirely comfortable because it wasn't fully formed.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be the only way to deal with a complex project with so many moving parts. You just would have gone crazy trying to map every micro thing out in a waterfall methodology.
Do you think that companies sometimes assume or wish or hope or expect that the process is going to be cleaner than that? Because I completely agree with you, right? Like, we have a saying here in America, maybe you guys use it as well, like that, you know, you don't always want to see how the sausage gets made, right? And sausage making in sales, sausage making in marketing can be quite ugly, right? Even as we were talking earlier about, you know, some work we've been doing on our house, and Douglas, who we were talking about before I came on, was saying like, it looks good. And on Instagram, it looks great.
It looks amazing.
What you didn't see was the carnage in the garage of all the stuff that I messed up with first. And so as it is with marketing as well, right? You try things, it doesn't work. You pivot one direction. You try an industry, you try a segment, it doesn't work. You try the sales model, it doesn't work. Like, the path to success is littered with failure.
But I think, again, it comes down to personality types. I'm really comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Because as long as I'm learning, okay, that didn't work, we'll try something else.
Yeah.
But it's more of that culture. So that's a management issue. It's a culture that failure is okay. I mean, at one point, I don't know if Cisco still do it, you know, to take a product photo, mm-hmm. you had, like, it had to be at this angle with this. I mean, it was so perfect.
Yeah.
You know, and access to phones and at real time, that's changing things now.
Yep.
And you do get a little bit more of the ugly stuff in terms of the production. But equally, I mean, somebody was telling me they went to Brighton the other day. They just come from Australia, and they said, oh yeah, I saw Brighton Pier on Instagram.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And I went there, and when I got there, it wasn't quite so cool.
You have to have a high tolerance for chaos to make this work sometimes. And I think, and I really do, again, back to culture, a culture of failure, a culture of acceptance of failure as the path to success. I mean, there's, you know, product WD-40, which I just kind of take for granted. It fixes things, makes things not squeak. I mean, you know why it's called WD-40, right?
I have no idea.
It's because it took 39 failures to get to the formula that worked. So 40 was kind of like a take. Take 2, take 3, take 10, take 12. Take 40 actually worked. So it took them 40 tries to come up with a product that we all just think, oh, that's great, just take it for granted. Mm. And so it goes with a lot of things. You know, we talk about GE. I mean, there's a million versions of the light bulb that didn't work. We see the Instagram at the end. We see the 5% of things that are successful, and we don't always see the rest of it. But that's part of the process. And honestly, the more we talk to companies of different sizes and different industries, even at a conference like this, like this morning at breakfast, talking to some people that were coming from all different kinds of companies. Talked to a guy last night who is the video content producer for Lowe's, the home improvement superstores. Talked to a guy this morning who is the sole marketer for a suburban library outside of Cleveland, right? And she's wondering if this conference is going to be relevant to her, because she's worried it's going to be a bunch of big company marketing and a big company ideas. And one of the benefits of coming to this kind of a conference is if people are honest with themselves, they're like, listen, none of us have this figured out. And if we have it figured out, it's about to change, and then we're not going to have it figured out. So if we admit to each other that we are all struggling, we are all testing, we are all failing, we are all making this up as we go, maybe it's not quite that bad, but it's some version of that.
But you can make it up as you go in a manageable, controllable way.
Right.
It's not quite so random.
I agree with you.
You know, in my talk today on the rise of the data scientist, you know, I talk about the value of having data scientists internal. Like, some people are like, yeah, I can't afford that. I don't have them. Well, you can use external data scientists. But just like basic A/B testing on LinkedIn, you know, you'll say, okay, is it this or this? Is it this image or this image that works with my audience? That's accessible to everybody.
It is. But the discipline behind it that I don't see often enough is, once you do that test, B is wrong, A is right. How do you document that so that you never do B again? How do you make sure that successive teams that come after you, I mean, in maybe different circumstances, different markets, you can test B again and maybe it'll work. but at least to have the context of how and where and why it failed. I mean, one of the phrases that I hate when people use is the idea of throwing spaghetti on the wall, right? Which, you know, there's a booth here, there's a vendor here at the conference, and their theme is, I mean, they're an analytics firm, and they're like, you know,
I think I saw that,
you shouldn't, like, don't just throw spaghetti on the wall. And what they have in their booth is they have a plexiglass wall, and they have a vat. It's like 12 gallons of cooked spaghetti, so you can throw it on the wall.
Does it have sauce on it, or is it plain?
It's plain. I mean, there might be some olive oil. I don't know. I'm not touching that spaghetti at this point.
No, I haven't been to that one. I was more interested in the little bag that we got in our pack.
Yes.
That immediately looked like an airline emergency bag. Right. But apparently it's for
the candy. Yeah.
It's a candy. So
yeah, they probably should not have designed it to look like the sick bag on the airplane. Maybe not the best option. But no, I think
it was like an after party thing, like emergency kit or something. I don't know. I was got like someone looking at this thing.
Different stages of party. You got someone sponsoring the alcohol, someone sponsoring the Alka-Seltzer in the bag. Tomorrow morning, someone's gonna be walking around with the Tylenol. Like, we've got all bases covered. We're all good.
Yeah, because we've got like the 80s party tonight.
Yes.
And we've already had Rick Astley.
We've been Rickrolled already at this conference. We've been Rickrolled. There was a number of 80s music. All right. So, speaking of 80s music.
Yes.
There's a lip sync battle tonight.
Right.
What would Jason Miller do? And what would you, what not, what you would you do? What will you do tonight at lip sync battle?
Okay, right. So if Jason is like the godfather of content marketing and heavy metal.
Right.
Yeah, I'm like the disco diva. The complete polar opposite.
Okay, all right.
So, I actually came prepared for the 80s disco.
You did.
I have a Choose Life t-shirt.
Yes.
I was a Wham girl, and I could probably still recite without any titles Young Guns by Wham. The rap.
Wow.
So what would you do?
Oh my God. I just got to let that settle in for a minute. That'd be great.
I'll do it after. I'm not prepared to do it on camera.
There's a lot. I mean, honestly, you could go a lot of different directions. I could, I'm a big Metallica fan.
Okay.
So I could go.
So you're down there with Jason. You're not on there.
Well, I'm equal opportunity. Like, I like a lot of different kind of music. I'd probably either do some Metallica, maybe some Garth Brooks. I might do a little bit of old school Cherry Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. I mean, you could go old school. I've been listening to on the Sirius XM. I've been listening a lot to Backspin, which is 80s and 90s hip hop. I may not look like a hip hop kind of guy, but underneath this,
you're way cooler than me.
I can bring it.
Now I was all about
as long as
the
I don't do this. This is my version of jazz hands. Just stop right now.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see when you're on the dance floor later on. I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
So
follow up question: lip sync versus karaoke. Like, what do you prefer and why?
Neither.
Okay.
No, seriously, I would rather present in front of 4,000 people and do karaoke. There's tone deaf,
yeah,
and then there's me.
Well, but the nice thing about doing lip sync is you don't have to sing.
Yeah, okay,
right?
Karaoke then.
Well,
and
even if you love a song but don't know all the words, you can just go up there and watermelon, watermelon, watermelon. It looks like, you know, you didn't focus. Focus on your dance moves.
Okay, lip sync then. There's the answer.
Watermelon,
the answer.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I actually think that I was hanging out with Chris from Scorch. And I think he's actually going to a karaoke bar this evening. So
Or after?
I don't know. At some point this evening. So I was feeling a bit anxious about that.
It's going to be fun. I mean, there's, you can't go wrong with an 80s band. I mean, there's a lot of directions you could go with an 80s band. but we'll see how they do.
Indeed.
It'll be fun.
Indeed.